And now, your daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And what a great day it is, actually, for the President of the United States. First of all, he kicked off his long-awaited deal of the century, Middle East peace plan, to tumultuous applause at the White House. He was standing alongside the Israeli Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, and they both spoke. We'll play you highlights of that and then talk about whether this peace plan really is something new. I believe it is. I believe it's hopeful. It's constructive. And any fair-minded person who is not completely poisoned by partisanship and by a general dislike of President Trump should rally behind the president in supporting this plan, which actually could be a brand new dawn, a new day for the Palestinians, could greatly, greatly advance the cause of peace if we can somehow transcend some of the sniping in the midst of a presidential election. Speaking of that sniping in the midst of a presidential election, David Frum is no fan of President Trump, but he has a brilliant piece in Atlantic about why Bernie can't win and yet why no Democrat can win unless they somehow capture some of Bernie's unique formula, his magic, his secret sauce. So what is it that old Bernie has that's different from other Democrats that seems to be driving him toward the nomination? We'll talk about that with David Frum. We'll also talk about a new book about the bomb. Are we really like just minutes from midnight now that there's going to be nuclear war devastating all of us? And which presidents have done the worst job in handling the awesome power of nuclear weapons? And speaking of nuclear options and nuclear weapons, they just finished just moments ago at the U.S. Senate of the concluding presentations from the president's defense team. And I got to tell you that starting last night, partially with Alan Dershowitz, and say what you will about Alan, even those who hate his guts, and there are plenty of people on the left and plenty of people on the right who hate Alan Dershowitz's guts, but he is a very smart guy and a very persuasive lawyer, and he did a great job. But so did Pat Cipollone, who is the White House counsel. He works for the White House. He's not President Trump's personal lawyer. That's Jay Sekulow here. And, of course, Rudy Giuliani in a completely different and less constructive context. But Pat Cipollone, I give him full kudos. He did just an outstanding job. You got to hear it. Wrapping up this discussion on impeachment. And I honestly believe he may have reached some people. Maybe, just maybe. Because this is the most effective presentation so far of the case for getting rid of these impeachment charges and then going on to fight out our issues in the election, which is where they should be fought out. He actually did this, Pat Cipollone, by playing a devastating montage. I'd never seen it before. I don't think anybody had seen it before. I think nobody had assembled it before. But kudos to the president's team for putting it together. It was a montage highlighting the hypocrisy of Democrats, many of whom are sitting right there in the Senate chamber, some of whom are among the House managers for the Democrats, like Zoe Lofgren. And it shows these people and what they said about the Clinton impeachment, where, surprise, surprise, they were on the other side. This is Pat Cipollone today, just moments ago, setting up this montage, taking us in the Wayback Machine back to 1999. Listen.
You just look at the articles of impeachment. The articles of impeachment fall far short of any constitutional standard, and they are dangerous. And if you look to the words from the past that I think are instructive, as I said last night, they're instructive because they were right then and they're right now. And I'll leave you with some of those words.
Okay, now he plays this actual montage, and these are all Democratic members of the House or the Senate speaking against the Clinton impeachment and making the same arguments, making them very well, that defenders of President Trump are making right now. Listen to these Democrats.
There must never be a narrowly voted impeachment or an impeachment supported by one of our major political parties and opposed by the other. Such an impeachment will produce the divisiveness and bitterness in our politics for years to come and will call into question the very legitimacy of our political institutions.
This is unfair to the American people. By these actions, you would undo the free election that expressed the will of the American people in 1996. In so doing, you will damage the faith the American people have in this institution and in the American democracy. You will set the dangerous precedent that the certainty of presidential terms, which has so benefited our wonderful America, will be replaced by the partisan use of impeachment. Future presidents will face election, then litigation, then impeachment. The power of the president will diminish in the face of the Congress, a phenomenon much feared by the founding fathers.
That's so long,
we are
right.
Permitting a constitutional coup d'etat, which will haunt this body and our country forever. I warn my colleagues that you will reap the bitter harvest of the unfair partisan seeds you sow today. The constitutional provision for impeachment is a way to protect our government and our citizens, not another weapon in the political arsenal.
I expect history will show that we've lowered the bar on impeachment so much. We have broken the seal on this extremely extreme penalty so cavalierly, that it will be used as a routine tool to fight political battles. My fear is that when a Republican wins the White House, Democrats will demand payback.
You were right. But I'm sorry to say you were also prophetic.
Okay, this is devastating. And Bob Menendez was one of the voices you heard up there. He's a current U.S. senator. And of course, hearing from Senator Schumer, who looked a little bit different some 21 years ago. Look, this is devastating. And again, I do think that people in the Senate chamber were probably paying attention. Why? Well, because they want to see if they're included, because a lot of these people have been around for a long time. And this makes such a profound point. And finally, driving it home and wrapping up the president's case, Pat Cipollone didn't thunder. He didn't scream. He approached it in, I think, exactly the right way. And kudos to him, which is just trying to get people to open minds a little bit and to understand why it is that this impeachment was always going to fail. Listen to Pat Cipollone.
And I think I couldn't say it better myself, so I won't. You know what the right answer is in your heart. You know what the right answer is for our country. You know what the right answer is for the American people. What they are asking you to do is to throw out a successful president on the eve of an election with no basis and in violation of the Constitution. It would dangerously change our country and weaken forever all of our democratic institutions. You all know that's not in the interest of the American people. Why not trust the American people with this decision? Why tear up their ballots? Why tear up every ballot across this country? You can't do that. You know you can't do that.
There are lots of reasons they can't do it. And the one overwhelming reason is they just don't have the votes. They don't. And I know, because I get into these conversations all the time, and there are people that I greatly, greatly respect who say, look, this is really a matter of setting a precedent, because we can't say that what President Trump did regarding Ukraine was okay. We can't just say it's okay. And so you've got to stand up against it, even though it's very, very obvious this impeachment will not succeed. You got to take a stand. You got to stand up against it. Here's the problem. If you really believe this is an important principle, and I think that's the right argument, then you are undermining that principle by proceeding with an impeachment that you know will fail. The one thing to keep in mind, and I say it all the time, it's 20 votes, it's 20 votes, it's 20 votes. They cannot find 20 Republicans, and I don't care what John Bolton says. Yes, I think he should testify. I think they should go ahead and let John Bolton testify. And I know that today, General Kelly, the former White House chief of staff, former Homeland Security director, a key part of the Trump administration, said he believes John Bolton. That's at least the report. Okay, but it's not going to make a difference. Could it make a difference in one or two votes? Maybe. Maybe. It's not going to make a difference for 20 votes. So the point is, if you insist in going forward with an impeachment discussion and debate and impeachment charges against the President of the United States, when you know you can't succeed, you're not setting an example that says, well, we're going to show future presidents you can't get away with this stuff. What you're showing is you're showing future presidents and maybe even this president in a second term. Sure, you can get away with it. And by the way, that's another factor here. It is increasingly likely that President Trump will win his second term. And I think that everybody who's looking at it, if you're looking at this, this is President Trump is doing this huge, huge rally coming up in New Jersey. I think it's tonight, isn't it? Yeah, it's tonight. Okay. I don't know. This is maybe not the best thing for the campaign, but you can see some of the video. It's breathtaking, and it's not fake video. This is not fake news. It's real. There are people waiting out in front of the venue to get in. Now, why are they waiting out in front of the venue to get in? The Wildwoods Convention Center holds 7,500 people. Do you know how many tickets have gotten requests for so far? 175,000. Okay, now, what does that tell you? It doesn't tell you that President Trump is going to win some kind of overwhelming majority necessarily, though he might. It tells you that there is real, real enthusiasm there. And anyone who is discounting the possibility that President Trump wins re-election is fooling themselves. Anyone who takes that position. It is not only possible, it is likely, it is more likely than not that President Trump will win the election. Now, a lot of time between now and then, sure. But see, what you're doing with this impeachment, which will fail, is giving President Trump an absolutely free hand in this second term. In other words, nobody believes that even if the Democrats hold on to the House of Representatives, and they may not, that they can go back to this well again and put the country through this again. Because particularly impeachment is at its high water mark today. And yeah, they may find some polls that say 52% or 54% or something like that if Americans want to see him removed from office. Watch that collapse when this is over. Who's going to think this was a great idea, that this was a famous victory after the Democrats lose here? It will not somehow punish Trump for any wrongdoing on Ukraine. It will encourage him to basically do what he pleases to do in his second term. There's another factor here. People bring up all the time. It's one of those things that you hear again and again and again, is Trump is a danger, and every single day that he continues as president is a danger to the republic, and that's why we needed to bring this impeachment. So what is it about a failed impeachment that makes him less dangerous? I don't get it. And I believe in miracles, but sometimes – you have to count on your own efforts. And there is no miracle about to happen that is going to all of a sudden win those 20 Republican votes and deliver impeachment to the Democrats. It's a disaster. And Alan Dershowitz made that argument last night, and he alluded to history with some knowledge of history in a very relevant way. Here was Professor Dershowitz speaking last night, not on Saturday Night Live, and far more effectively. Listen.
I will now give you a list of presidents who in our history have been accused of abusing their power, who would be subject to impeachment under the House manager's view of the Constitution. George Washington, refusal to turn over documents related to the Jay Treaty. John Adams, signing and enforcing the Alien and Sedition Laws. Thomas Jefferson, purchasing Louisiana without congressional authorization. I'll go on. John Quincy Adams, Martin Van Buren, John Tyler, arbitrary, despotic, and corrupt use of the veto power. James Polk, here I quote Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln accused Polk of abusing his power of his office, contemptuously disregarding the Constitution, usurping the role of Congress, and assuming the role of dictator.
That
he
was
didn't seek to impeach him, he just sought to defeat him. Abraham Lincoln was accused of abusing his power for suspending the writ of habeas corpus during the Civil War.
Okay, and many, many other charges against Lincoln. And then he goes on and listing, and it's true, all of the presidents, and he doesn't even touch all of them because there are even many more, Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt and, of course, Lyndon Johnson and, of course, John Kennedy, all accused of abuse of power because this is a political issue, not a legal issue, and it should continue to be, as Dershowitz says.
Even if a president, any president, were to demand a quid pro quo as a condition to sending aid to a foreign country, obviously a highly disputed matter in this case, that would not by itself constitute an abuse of power. Consider the following hypothetical case that is in our news today as the Israeli prime minister comes to the United States for meetings. Let's assume a Democratic president tells Israel that foreign aid authorized by Congress will not be sent, or an Oval Office meeting will not be scheduled unless the Israelis stop building settlements. Quid pro quo. I might disapprove of such a quid pro quo demand on policy grounds, but it would not constitute an abuse of power. Quid pro quo alone is not a basis for abuse of power. It's part of the way foreign policy has been operated by presidents since the beginning of time.
He is absolutely correct in that. And by the way, that idea of withholding or delaying aid as a push to stop settlements, the first President Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, did that with the Israeli Prime Minister at the time, Yitzhak Shamir. And then he was forced to relent because it became very politically controversial. And but this the difference, of course, and I would answer Professor Dershowitz on this, was that President Trump was keeping it all secret. When people have made that kind of quid pro quo push against Israel and against other nations, most of the time, or at least some of the time, it's been public, and certainly was with George Herbert Walker Bush. But here, does the fact that it was behind the scenes, does that suddenly create grounds for impeachment? There is much more from Alan Dershowitz, Ken Starr, and from you if you want. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. We're also going to be speaking to David Frum coming up about Bernie's chances. Good chance for the nomination. No chance for victory in November. So what's the deal? Also, what do you do about a guy who runs over a homeless person, woman, who was sleeping outside his garage? We'll get to that and more coming up on the Medved Show. I guess it does make some sense for the Democrats to be pivoting on the over to the issue of witnesses, and they are, because that's an issue where they can win, and I think probably they deserve to win. I mean, if John Bolton has a story to tell, and it's a story that contradicts the narrative that has been provided so far by the White House, let him tell the story and face cross-examination. It's much better to do that than to simply have him come out with a book where all he'll be facing will be media interviews, most of which will be very supportive of whatever Bolton has to say if it's negative toward Trump. Let him face cross-examination by both sides as a witness before the U.S. Senate in an impeachment trial. It's important enough. And Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler and the impeachment managers are just doing a press conference where they're talking about this case of witnesses. And they're resisting the idea of Hunter Biden and Joe Biden coming and testifying. And it's obvious why, because it would be a bad look for somebody who's running for president to be answering questions about what went on in Ukraine. And the Democratic excuse, and again, it's not idiotic. What they say is this has nothing to do with the impeachment charges against President Trump. All of this happened long before Trump was president. It happened under the Obama administration. Nobody is talking about anything that involves the charges against President Trump. And this is not a trial of Joe Biden. This is a trial of Donald Trump. But it was actually the Democrats who focused initially on Joe Biden, saying that what the president was doing here was all a political dirty trick, which was aimed at discrediting a potential opponent. And the Republican answer is, well, he was actually sincerely concerned about corruption in the Ukraine and Biden's involvement in it. Now, do I think that's true? I think it's true that he was trying to kneecap Joe Biden, but he was also concerned about Ukrainian corruption. In any event, if that is the debate right now, if that is an issue at the trial, what was President Trump's motivation? Did he have corrupt intent when he was offering this quid pro quo to Ukraine, the alleged quid pro quo that the White House still disputes? Okay, if he had corrupt intent, then it is highly relevant as to whether or not he had a reasonable basis for assuming a bad behavior and corrupt behavior on the part of the person whose investigation he sought. Or is this just a political attempt to discredit his potential opponent? On the Medved show, let's go to in Newcastle. Is that Don? You bet.
My point about witnesses, or they had 17 witnesses in the House of Representatives, none for President Trump. Why don't we have 17 witnesses in the U.S. Senate, all for President Trump? And then if they want to have additional witnesses beyond that, negotiate that. But they have a one-sided approach in the House of Representatives, and there's no balance in this at all in terms of what's happening in the Senate.
Right. And I think, by the way, given the fact that Republicans do control the Senate, that even some of those Republicans who include apparently today potentially Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, those Republicans will not be for calling only Democratic witnesses. They will insist on calling some of the other witnesses, whether they call the whistleblower. I don't know if that's particularly relevant. It might be relevant to call Adam Schiff to ask him about his involvement and contacts with the whistleblower before he filed his report. So I think what you're saying is entirely reasonable. You can't have it both ways. Either witnesses are necessary for both sides or they're necessary for neither. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Kay, Salt Lake City. You're on the Michael Medved show. Hello, Kay.
Hi, Michael. You mentioned that you thought the difference between this and other cases of abuse of power was that it was the president kept it secret. But I also think that the Democrats are trying to make the case that it's also because it was personal, only personal. And I thought in that regard, Pam Bondi's comments last night were really fascinating to me, the history of the Biden involvement with Burisma, clear back to 2014, when even the Washington Post, the New York Times, ABC News, ABC News said that at best it was nepotism, at worst it was nefarious.
Yeah, it was a terrible idea, and it may end up costing Hunter Biden's father his campaign. I think what I took, and I think was questionable about Pam Bondi's presentation, and my problem with it, is this prosecutor who Biden was pushing to fire was no anti-corruption crusader. He was part of the corruption. And this, honestly, is a matter that's provable. In other words, even the current Ukrainian government acknowledges that Viktor Shokin needed to be fired. And he wasn't fired because he was investigating Burisma. And I think that's the... Now, is it still dubious for Joe Biden to be involved, considering the fact that his son was on the board of Burisma, and Burisma was one of the companies that at least potentially could have been investigated by somebody? Yeah, and it was also deeply foolish for Joe Biden to be boasting about basically bossing around the government of Ukraine. Look, Kay, part of this is the problem we have with the vice presidency. So in other words, vice presidents don't have anything to do. And ironically, what Barack Obama said, oh, here, Joe, you take care of Ukraine. Go fix it. And it gave the vice president something to do. And for somebody like Joe Biden, who's wanted to be president for a long time, it was almost irresistible for him to claim that level of success. I appreciate your call. And thanks for it, Kay. Let me go back to Alan Dershowitz last night, because he concluded his remarks, again, I think, with very strong arguments. And this is really not as to who did what to whom, or who said this, or what did the president mean, or what did the president know. It's a basic constitutional understanding. What is an appropriate basis for impeaching and removing a president? And here's what Professor Dershowitz had to say.
I stand before you today as I stood in 1973 and 1974 for the protection of the constitutional and procedural rights of Richard Nixon, who I personally abhorred and whose impeachment I personally favored. And as I stood for the rights of Bill Clinton, who I admired and whose impeachment I strongly opposed. I stand against the application and misapplication of the constitutional criteria in every case and against any president without regard to whether I support his or her parties or policies. I would be making the very same constitutional argument had Hillary Clinton, for whom I voted, been elected and had a Republican House voted to impeach her on these unconstitutional grounds.
Okay, this goes to this terrific column, and it really is, by Nick Kristof. Nick Kristof is a big liberal, and he writes a column under the heading, "What if it were Obama?" And he actually cites Cass Sunstein, who has also been a guest on this show, as has Nick Kristof, another big liberal. What if it were Obama? How would Democrats react to charges if Obama had done exactly the same things that Trump did? You say that's impossible? Hold on. We'll be right back with that. What if it were the shoe were on the other foot if it were Obama? We'll get to that coming up. On the Michael Medved Show, I do want to acknowledge one thing. Today is a, I think it's a great day because we're nearing the end. We really are. It's not the end. It's not even the beginning of the end, but it is, as Churchill once said, the end of the beginning. The Senate is taking a break. The president's defense team concluded their presentation, and they concluded very effectively, I thought. And tomorrow they're going to be back for question time. But it's not going to be as exciting as that sounds because they have to submit the questions in writing, which will then be read by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. It'll be interesting. But then they will proceed to, after that, the decision, which could be important or not, about whether or not they are going to call witnesses and what witnesses they will agree to call. 1-800-955-1776, our phone number. Nick Kristof, in his piece, What If It Were Obama, actually poses three thought experiments. And they're all stimulating, and two of them, I think, are kind of silly. One of them is very important. The one that's very important is the one that I mentioned. Try to imagine that it were Obama. And he talks about, in Cass Sunstein's fine book about impeachment, which is what he was on our show to discuss, Cass Sunstein, a longtime law professor at University of Chicago and more recently at Harvard, Cass Sunstein says, suppose that a president engages in certain actions that seem to you very, very bad. Suppose you are tempted to think that he should be impeached. You should immediately ask yourself, would I think the same thing if I loved the president's policies and thought he was otherwise doing a splendid job? Alternatively, if you oppose impeaching somebody, Sunstein said, would I think, you have to ask yourself, would I think the same thing if I abhorred the president's policies and thought he was otherwise doing a horrible job? And yes, that is the key question. And Nick Kristof writes, in practical terms, this amounts to, what if it were Obama who had been caught in this Ukraine scandal? And he writes, and he's honest about this. Good for him. I suspect that many Democrats would also switch sides, finding it easier to excuse misconduct by someone they admired and seeing it as more important in that situation to preserve executive privilege and leave it to voters to decide the matter in the fall. That's why we owe it to ourselves as a matter of intellectual honesty to think through how we would react if it were the other guy on trial. Okay, good and fair. He then goes to this, and I think this is a little bit far-fetched. He says a third thought experiment is simply, what if Trump weren't president, but was like almost any other person in America? And then he uses the following analogy, which I don't think makes any sense at all. He says, what if he were a high school vice principal who ensured that a police detective's son would be accepted in an advanced placement class? And then added, I'd like you to do us a favor, though. And the favor would be an investigation of the vice principal's ex-wife before their upcoming child custody hearing in hopes of tilting the outcome in his favor. This is a ridiculous analogy. It bears no resemblance. And he says, of course, the vice principal would be fired. Here's the difference. When President Trump is asking about corruption, can we agree there's no problem? It's appropriate before you are releasing $391 million in foreign aid, it's appropriate to be concerned about corruption. So where did he go wrong? He mentioned the Bidens. Here's my thought experiment. If President Trump hadn't mentioned Joe and Hunter Biden, and he mentioned both of them, would there have been anything impeachable, even vaguely, about his phone call? And the answer is no. It would be totally legitimate for a president of the United States to ask about corruption. So is it really important enough, the fact that he foolishly, stupidly, inappropriately mentioned the names of two people that he wanted investigated, and they were people who were very much involved in the upcoming election? Should that be enough to lead to this? Basically having the whole world grind to a halt, except for the market that is dramatically up today. No, that makes no sense at all. And Ken Starr made that point in his presentation last night. He made it very clear that there were no crimes that were alleged in the articles of impeachment. Listen.
And so the appropriate question, were crimes alleged in the articles in the common law of presidential impeachment? In Nixon, yes. In Clinton, yes. Here, no. A factor to be considered as the judges in the high court come, as you will, individually to your judgment.
And then this about how impeachment has changed in terms of its fundamental understanding. Listen.
Instead of a once-in-a-century phenomenon, which it had been, presidential impeachment has become a weapon to be wielded against one's political opponent. In her thoughtful Wall Street Journal op-ed a week ago Saturday, Peggy Noonan wrote this: impeachment has now been normalized. It won't be a once-in-a-generation act, but an every administration act. Democrats will regret it when Republicans are handing out the pins of the signing ceremony. When we look back down the corridors of time, we see that for almost our first century as a constitutional republic, the sword of presidential impeachment remained sheathed.
And then it was another century, more than another century, before there was a serious attempt to wield impeachment again. In other words, we went 200 years with only one impeachment, the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. Then we had Nixon in 1974, and then we had Clinton in 1998-99, and now we have President Trump. It should not be regularized. This is not good for the country. And I don't care who is elected president next time. I mean, even if, God forbid, 1,000 times we have a President Bernie Sanders, we'll be speaking with David Frum, former aide to President Bush, about why Bernie Sanders is not going to win the election. But even if we had a Bernie Sanders there, the idea of contesting Bernie Sanders, not in Congress, not on legislation, not with investigations, but with a formal impeachment, passing articles of impeachment on a nakedly partisan basis, it's a terrible precedent. And it's terrible for the republic. And honestly, fair-minded people, even people who fear and loathe and despise President Trump, ought to realize it. We will go to the conversation about the Sanders surge, how real is it and what's behind it, and why it has a limiting power. And I also want to mention one thing. Yesterday was a very important day for me. I didn't mention it on the air, deliberately not, because my wife was unable to hear. But I do want to acknowledge my 35th wedding anniversary, which actually formally was yesterday, but acknowledging it today, because it is a happy, happy anniversary for me of the best day in my life that gave me a tremendously enhanced ability to celebrate, enjoy, and savor every single day in this greatest nation on God's green earth.